Hello, everyone. Welcome. So glad you joined us tonight. Welcome to Real Recovery. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio. Across the way, George P. Fraser, Alex on the board, and the Danimal in the phone room. That's the team tonight. We've got a great show coming up. We have Rona Epstein going to be on the studio line coming up in just a little bit. So, George, you know how excited we are when we have Rona as a guest.
One of our best guests by far.
We just
great
love
show.
Her like crazy. She has got quite a story of addiction herself, but it's primarily an eating addiction. And she's written a book called Food Triggers, and she's also now just got this wonderful workshop she's got in the Philadelphia area called Taste of Freedom Workshop.
What is that, a three-day workshop?
Three-day workshop that helps you get out of your addiction of food.
Well, it's an intensive, and I like those. You can go in and really work on your stuff hardcore for 3 days.
And, yeah.
Real good deal there.
And that's on RonaEpstein.com. We'll put that all on the website if you're interested and want to check it out a little bit more. George, we got step three tonight we're going to talk about, so let's get going.
Well, we do. It's a three-day workshop, and we're on step three. I mean, there's no coincidence in God's economy, Bill. And step three is we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. And I always had a problem with this step that I hear a lot of people talk about. Well, I'm going to turn my will over to God. Like, God's will is not going to happen if we don't go along with it. I think a real good way of looking at this step for us, Bill, is I'm going to stop fighting God on his will and be obedient. I think that's a real good shortcut here.
George, do you ever hear regarding step three in meetings, does someone ever say, okay, this is the step where we launch out on a course of vigorous action, and we're going to do personal house cleaning, and we're going to do stuff we've never attempted before? Do you ever hear that?
I don't hear the word vigorous a lot in my life.
No, you're too old to hear the word vigorous, but I'm just talking about like in context of meetings.
Well, I think when we work with people, what I hear the most is this is really a tall order here, that turning my whole life over to God, I'm not sure I'm ready to do that. I'm not sure I'm going to sign up for that. I want elimination of my problem, and I want God's help in getting me what I want, but to turn my life over to God to what he wants me to do, huh, that's a different matter.
Well, if you make this decision, if step three, and you turn your life and will over to the care of God, it could have a permanent effect. And it's usually followed by a strenuous effort and a lot of work and a lot of faith and a lot of surrender.
Yeah, I would look on this is one we do every day, and a lot of times during the day I have to make a decision to do God's will rather than my will. There's a prayer associated with this that basically is saying, help me to do your will and get myself out of it. We have a lot of people that we work with, Bill, identify themselves as egomaniacs with inferiority complexes, and it really makes a lot of sense if you're trying to be God. You got the ego part, but you don't have the game to back it up. And it's kind of like the little kid we are, where I've got this, Dad, Mom, unless I get in trouble, and then I'll call on you. And there is a father relationship here, but it's a lot easier as we go along and we get some maturity in our faith to go to him first thing in the day and just say, hey, I'm checking in. What do you want me to do today? Help me to be obedient.
So, George, when you look at step three, though, are there some concept words in there that don't necessarily necessitate action? They just talk about it? Isn't this the step that you talk about, the line with the three frogs on
the log?
On the log. Isn't that where that comes from?
Yes.
Well, tell our listener.
Okay, are you going to get it right this time?
I'll get it right.
Okay, there's three frogs on a log, and one of them makes a decision to jump into the pond. Mm-hmm. How many frogs are on the log?
And of course, the answer is three.
Correct.
Because although you've made a decision to do it, you haven't actually done it.
Exactly.
Okay.
But so, you need to make the decision before the action, and you're quite correct. This requires some follow-through, and it requires it every day. Jesus said you have to pick up your cross and deny yourself daily.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to get into the habit here. You might want to look at Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, because that's what we're doing. We're trusting God and acknowledge him in all our ways, and he's going to make our path straight.
So, George, I think the big third step question would be this.
Okay.
All right, here we go.
I'm ready. Bring it.
This is what I think it should be. Do you now decide to take the actions necessary to turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand him?
I like that. You always make it sound like you're a prosecuting attorney.
All right. Now, this raises another big question. Will you turn your life and your will over to the care of God as you understand him? So the million-dollar question is exactly who are you turning yourself over to?
And yes.
Let me just say, Jesus has assumed authority to forgive sin. He has claimed he alone gives eternal life. He claims he is the truth. He claims he has the authority to judge the world. He claims that he has alone the ability and the willingness to receive worship. Okay? So that's who I think we're talking about.
That's who we go to.
That's who we go to. So as, you know, turning your life over to the care of God as you understand him, how do we encourage our listeners to say, make sure you're understanding the right God that you're turning your will over to?
That is the
key. We call him by name, and his name is Jesus.
You need to get to know him, and the best way to do that is to be with other believers and to open the Bible and read about who he is. Not who you think he is, but who is he really? And he, Bill, I believe it's the prodigal son story. He'll more than meet you halfway on this. But we need to get into the habit of doing this in all our affairs. And of a lot of the people, myself in my recovery, I just figured once I stopped drinking and doing coke, I'd be fine. But the underlying problems are the self-centeredness, the selfishness, the dishonesty, and the fears. And the only way I can work this step in a halfway decent manner is to turn it over to God every day on my knees and pray for sobriety and the power to carry out what he wants me to do. And I don't always know what that is, but he'll let me know. And a lot of this is not making decisions like we used to, but waiting on God. Psalm 46:10, I believe it is, be still and know that I am God. And he'll let you know what to do. We need to have some patience here, Bill, and some willingness to do this. This is a tall order. It's tough.
George, in 1 John 3:18, it says, "Dear children, let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth."
Yes.
Talk about that.
Well, I think what we need to do is get out of the center of our universe and hand that one back to God. Now, he still has it, but this is about us realizing that and turning it over, making a decision that I'm going to let God run my life. There used to be a bumper sticker that we'd see a long time ago that says, "God is my co-pilot." Well, that's totally wrong. No, he's piloting.
Mm-hmm.
Quit driving the plane, quit driving the bus, hand it over to God, do what he wants you to do, rather than having God as kind of our trusted servant to give me what I want and what I need.
Mm-hmm. George, I want to talk tonight just to set up our guest, because Rona Epstein is just such a delight, and
yes,
she's got so much to bring to our listeners tonight. And she has struggled with a food addiction, and this, of course, this is such a sensitive subject because every day we have to get up and eat. So it's tricky.
That's why a lot of us do get up, actually. If you eliminate the coffee,
primary
I'm still
motivation.
Asleep, right?
Primary motivation, yeah. So it's something that can be abused easily, and we certainly see that as kind of the acceptable sin, just the overeating. And
I think in the evangelical circles, in my humble opinion, and we'll get some calls tonight, Danimal, so get ready, I believe that obesity is the acceptable sin and of a lot of Christians I know. I know for me, when I got sober, I got up to 206. I couldn't get over 200 until they came out with the fudge-covered Oreos, and then I launched it. But
well, it's a little push over the edge.
But,
for
you know, I was raised in a family that had a candy manufacturing company, and I will tell you, looking back now, and when she comes on, we can talk about this if we have time. I've been sober 31 years, but I believe my first addiction was to sugar. And I didn't realize it. You know, I thought it was nicotine when I started smoking, but from a little kid, you know, the sugary cereal. I'm a class A of why you don't put your sugar cereal and juice and put your kid in front of a TV with cartoons. It doesn't work well as an adult.
Yeah.
But I think about that on how that affects your mood, remember? You know, the ice cream man, everybody's running after that little truck. Well, I think that's when it starts for a lot of us. It'll be interesting what her take is on that. But we do have to eat. And a lot of people, when they get into recovery, especially in the old recovery circles, they would have sugar. They would, you know, I'm not going to drink, but I'm going to go out and get some ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
And it can have the same effect long term. And I think it's the hardest thing to treat because you can't abstain from food.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a little break in just a minute, but we just want to let you know our guest is just one of our all-time favorites.
Yep.
Rona Epstein grew up in a Jewish family. Raised by obviously Jewish parents and in a culture, and then ended up with an eating addiction, and now has a master's degree in counseling. I think she's got a PhD as
I
well.
I think she has a PhD.
Yeah, I know.
Though.
I got to check my facts. We'll get her to to bring her credentials, refresh it when we bring her back on the air. We're going to take a little break and lots of show coming up, so go nowhere. Be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Bill and George here tonight. Thanks for being with us, and we hope you're enjoying the show so far. George, I just had to check Rona's credentials, and she is a Psy D, right? Did I say that right?
Yes.
What does that mean again?
That means she's a Psy D.
Well, explain what that is.
I believe it's like a doctorate in psychology.
Okay. All right.
I don't have one. It's a pay grade above me and above all of us.
There's a lot of things you don't have.
No, I don't.
Yeah.
So.
Anyway.
She's qualified.
She is. She's a licensed addictions counselor and, again, Real Recovery's favorite guest. Rona, welcome back to the show.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Okay, you got to sort some of this out for us now. Do you think sugar is the first addiction kids have?
Well, I would say that it probably is. I can't see what else would come before sugar, and certainly because of lack of knowledge. I think that many people become start off giving their kids treats, thinking that they're doing something fun and nice and it's all happy. And all the ads that they have on TV for cereals that are full of sugar. Yeah, I mean, we're training ourselves, actually, to be addicted, but we don't know it. I don't think anybody really means to be starting an addiction, but that's what we're doing.
I've always preferred white powders, and it started with sugar. You know, can't get enough Super Sugar Crisp and Sugar Pops and Frosted Flakes.
Oh, yeah.
And what a way to start the day. And then that.
Yeah, you're not kidding.
We learn those peaks, don't we? You know, and that has to trigger something. It's changed because they recognize that now and they've cut back on the sugars, right?
Well, I think they're making efforts. Certainly, there's been more and more awareness. The movie Fed Up came out last year, which is a documentary with Katie Couric and a lot of really great doctors doing research on how they're saying sugar is 8 times more addictive than cocaine. And they really went after the food industry and made a case that we're creating an obese and a sick culture, and that we need to wake up and see that sugar is really can be dangerous if it's being abused. And they had all these teenagers that were obese on the movie. I highly recommend it, but there definitely is an effort to reduce it. But I still think there's a lot of ignorance about this issue.
Well, there's a lot in this studio, I'll tell you that. It's interesting now, looking back now, does that help you work with your clients? I'm assuming they're mostly late adolescents and in an adulthood, about how it started?
Oh, absolutely. It really does help when people understand the science behind it, that and they never understood. They just, you know, people come into my office on a regular basis and just start sobbing because they don't know what's wrong with them. They're like, you know, I'm obsessed with food. I come in. They tell me every day when I wake up in the morning, all the way until I go to bed, no matter what I'm doing, I'm always thinking about food. I can't stop. And they don't know what's happening to them. And this could be going on for years and years, and they just feel like a total failure in life. And for some people, it's really serious. I mean, it could really destroy their whole lives. And their health and everything, and no one ever explained to them that there was a physiological addiction. We know that with alcohol or drugs, that it's addictive. We understand you have to be careful with alcohol. We're warned about that before people become of age or before they're teenagers. We talk about it. We explain that it's addictive. But we never did that with this, and we still don't really know that it can be addictive. Most people don't know. I think when I talk about this, that most people, they can say, yeah, I can understand it being addictive because, sure, I love my, you know, cookies or my cake, and they understand sort of getting, wanting more, but they don't really see it the same way as cocaine or heroin. They don't really see how the compulsion, the addiction, and how devastating that it really can be, that it's just not as innocent as it looks.
Does it cause
people's lives are being ruined?
Yeah. Now, when we look at alcohol, for a lot of us, once we have one drink, there's that intense craving that leads to more. Cookies can do the same thing, can't they? Once you have one,
Absolutely.
You're gone.
Absolutely. That's why we have an obesity epidemic. That's why the people, there's all the people, there's a third of the U.S. population that is considered obese, statistically. And that's not counting all the people who are having trouble with overeating but are managing their weight, you know, either through purging or dieting or exercise.
Through exercise, huh?
Yeah, that's a big
they have exercise bulimia. People who eat out of control, and then they can keep their weight under control by doing excessive amounts of exercise to get rid of their weight. So they don't get fat. I have a client who used to talk about eating a whole pizza and then go out and run 10 miles or whatever he was doing, and he managed his weight that way for a long time, but eventually the addiction takes over. I mean, it doesn't last.
Yeah, you can't. I heard somebody say you can't compete with what you eat.
You can't what?
You can't compete with what you eat.
Compete with what you eat, yes.
Yeah.
Eventually, I don't think you can really take care of it with exercise, but and there's a lot of people who are trying.
Yeah, I mean, if you eat a whole pizza and run 10 miles, the pizza's still way ahead winning.
Well, I think you can do that till you hit about 45, but don't ask me how I know that. So anyway, what's the next subject here? I think a lot of us who are in recovery do switch addictions, and the food is natural one after, you know, quitting drinking. We think it's not as harmful, but it is. When you talk about obesity, can you give us a definition on that? Is there a clinical definition of obesity?
Yeah, there is, but I never remember numbers, so I'm terrible. You would think here I am an expert, and of course there is something. The doctors have BMI, you know, mm-hmm. body mass index, and they judge it by that. And I don't remember the exact numbers. No matter how many times I try to memorize those things, they don't stick in my head.
No, I get that, too. Would it be safe to say, though, if a person thinks they're overweight, unless they're anorexic or something, that they probably are? If you think you have a problem with food, you probably do?
Oh, I would say so. And I really don't think it has to do with your weight. It really doesn't. I've worked with some very normal weight people who are completely insane and out of control with their relationship with food. I mean, you know, if you think about it, even some of the people who are dieting and starving between their binges, they're sometimes even worse than the person who's just given to compulsive eating, because they have it's taken up all day. I mean, they're either thinking about food or also thinking about how they're going to lose weight, and it's a full-time job.
So the obsession is a real red flag here.
Oh yeah, that's definitely a sign and a symptom of addiction. Not an obsession.
Now, Rona, I know that you had your own personal story, and for you it started when you were 12 or 13?
I would probably say that it started when I was younger. It was just that when I was 12 or 13 is when I went over the edge.
Okay.
But I was preoccupied with food when I was really little, and there was definitely signs that I was like, of course, I think most kids, they love their candy, but I was I definitely had it more so. Like, I was always looking for sweets. And also, my mom, she loves to say this, which, of course, I have some feelings about this, but I can't blame her anymore, because she just didn't know. But she said, you wouldn't eat anything else. And so, when I was very little, all I ate was sugar and white flour. I lived on pasta and every sort of sweet that you can imagine, Oreos and Pop-Tarts and Captain Crunch and all kinds of ice cream. And then for food, I was pretty much resistant to eating anything but spaghetti and peanut butter and jelly. And I think that's pretty much all I would eat. So I'd say I was pretty young, but I think when I was 12 or 13 is when I started becoming worried about my weight and started going on my first diet. And that's when I started to become bulimic and going between binging and purging and restricting, and it just got worse and worse from there.
You brought up a lot of old names. Captain Crunch, Bill and I are back on that. It's amazing, you know, to listen to that. I knew a lot of people like that. I was kind of that way myself. Growing up in the 60s and 70s for me, Rona, and all the commercials, you know, with the candy bars and all that, it was just kind of a lifestyle, and everybody did it. And pop, oh, my gosh, soda pop.
Yeah. Oh,
We're in the Midwest, we call it pop, but all the time. And didn't think anything of it. And then you get to be an adult, and it's a problem. When was the first time you remember that you tried to do something about it, that you were aware that this was causing issues in your life?
Well, actually, in my senior year of high school is when I hit bottom, and I was at the point where actually I wanted to die because I was so devastated by what was happening. First of all, as you said, you can't compete with what you eat. I had tried so many diets and exercise regimes, and I was taking amphetamines, and I was trying to starve myself. I would starve all day and binge all night. But I was losing, and I started losing the battle. I mean, the weight was coming on, even though I was purging and exercising exercised like crazy. My eating had gotten so out of control that I started packing on the pounds to the point where I was getting like to be fat. And well, for me, I mean, I have clients who are way fatter, but for me, it was way, you know, I was like, you know, I'm a normal weight now, but I was like four sizes bigger than I am now. I'm sure I would have been much bigger if I wasn't trying to starve myself in between my binges. I probably was eating enough to be severely obese in the way I was eating. But I had become devastated because nothing was working. Everything I tried to do to stop just was temporary. I would temporarily be able to follow a diet, but then as any addiction is, the periods of control become less and less, and I just wanted to die, and so that's when I started to get help, and I knew that a diet wasn't the answer. I knew already that at that point, at 17, I knew that there was no diet solution that was going to fix my eating problem, that I couldn't follow a diet, and basically took the first step. I already knew. Without ever going in a 12-step program, I knew that there was no chance that I would be able to follow a diet and that I couldn't stop. And I ended up finding a 12-step group for food addiction. And then I began to be met with understanding, and thankfully people understood and they were speaking my language. They talked about throwing food in the trash can and then taking it out. And, you know, never, that's something you wouldn't admit to anybody, but these people were telling the truth about how crazy they felt. And, you know, all of a sudden I knew that I found some place where people understood and people were getting better. So, yeah, but I was just 17. So I got wiped out pretty early.
How big a part of that is to realize that you're not alone with this?
Huge. I think it was huge because you just feel like everybody's just telling you to try this, just, you know, cut down on what you eat. Everybody's all interested in helping you lose weight. There's a million ways that you could. Everybody's got an idea. Just do this and do that. And everybody's got a plan. But then you walk in and it's like, yeah, these people understand what I'm going through. They understand that I can't stop. And that's just a wonderful thing. And actually, as a counselor, I'll say probably – I love watching people come back. You know, a lot of times people come to me first because they're safer coming to a counselor than they are. And they probably never heard of some of the 12-step programs either. A lot of people never heard of, they know of AA, but they never heard of OA or some of the other 12-step programs for food. And I'll often recommend that they go and they come back and they're like new people. I can't believe it. It's just the most amazing thing. I feel hope. And there's just something that happens when they're in the room with other people who get it.
While we're on that, so I'm aware of Overeaters Anonymous, but what other groups are there?
Well, there are different 12-step programs. There's a bunch of them, actually. There's Food Addicts Anonymous. There's Eating Disorders Anonymous. There's Bulimics Anonymous. I'm trying to think what else. There's a few, actually, probably more than a few. I tend to usually recommend OA, but there is value. I guess the thing is with the programs. There's some challenges with the programs. They're not as strong, and I think you were saying early before I got on, you were mentioning that the thing that's so hard about food is that you have to eat, and I think because of that, you don't have the kind of strength that you would find in AA, that the 12-step meetings for food tend to be weaker, and it's harder to find a good, strong meeting. And so people will often, you know, it's really, really difficult. And so, in Overeaters Anonymous, there's some really strong meetings, and there's a strong community, even by phone. Like, they have meetings around the clock on the phone. There's a lot. I always tell people there's bad meetings, and there's a lot more bad than good, but you've got to really search them out. The thing with FA, Food Addicts Anonymous, which is like the next more popular, I think OA has probably been around the longest. It's the first food program that there was, and it's a good 12-step program, and it's strong, but it's not as strict as FA. FA people, they all follow a very rigid food plan, and they kind of dictate how you eat, and I don't think everybody needs that kind of stringent food plan in food recovery, and that's where it's really different from drugs and alcohol. It's just a different thing because people have to learn how to manage food. And the different programs have a different philosophy on how you do that.
Well, we're going to take a little break, and if you have a question for Rona, would like to give us a call, you can do so, 1-877-933-2484. George, is there an anonymous group for looking at yourself in the mirror? Because you could join that one.
No, is that a problem?
No. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Real Recovery, show about addiction, hosted by two guys with limited appeal, Bill Arnold, George Fraser. That's the team tonight. Alex on the board, Danimal in the phone room. We had a call earlier, but I think it went away. And that's probably your fault, George.
A personal call for Danimal.
Yeah, he's probably just taking personal calls. We're talking to Rona Epstein tonight. We're talking about a very difficult subject to for us anyway to talk about, because it's about overeating, our relationship to food, and how we struggle with it, and how it affects our health and well-being and weight, and how we view ourselves. You know, God looks at us and sees Jesus in us if we're saved and born again, and yet it's very easy to be dissatisfied with how we feel, and we don't like the body we drag around all day, and it causes all kinds of problems, doesn't it, Rona?
Yes. No, you're absolutely right. It causes all kinds of problems.
Yeah. George, before we went to break, you were asking Rona about, we were talking about obesity and the idea that in Christianity, it seems to be that it's the one thing that we can sort of all get away with. And it's interesting when she talks about sugar being as addictive as cocaine, you can go into any church meeting and there's a plate full of cookies and cakes, and isn't it to some degree the equivalent of walking into church and having a bunch of beer on the table?
Should increase the attendance at the church, Bill.
You should go
to marketing. Yeah, I remember a church I went to, Rona, where you couldn't smoke, drink, dance, gamble. It was rather limited, but they'd have pie night all the time, and the people were obese. And, I mean, they're nice people. It was great pie, but we kind of that's always been acceptable.
Right. Well, yeah. And I think, again, I would say that people are generally clueless. They're skipping over the parts of the scripture that talk about the issues of gluttony. You know, how they're pointing their finger at other people and their troubles and not looking at their own. It's beyond me. But it's denial, and it's the culture, I think, just because we don't know. We don't understand. So, yeah, it's a huge problem.
So if I can get...
I mean, you look at it, even the leaders in the churches. I mean, how many of even some of the famous church leaders are severely obese?
Mm-hmm. I would love to get back to your personal story, Rona, because you're 17 years old, and here's this 17-year-old girl going to food Anonymous. Is it FA? Is that what it's called?
I was in a different 12-step program.
Okay, a different 12-step. Takes a lot of courage for a junior or senior in high school to be attending one of those meetings?
Oh, well, you know, honestly, I think it was really a miracle because at the point that I went, I had given up hope completely and I wasn't going to even try anything. And I don't even know why I went other than it must have been like a God thing that somehow I went because I really lost hope. Someone had told me about it and I don't know what made me go, but I did. And I was terrified and I probably never would have gone back except for there was a person there who was in her 20s and she grabbed onto me, took my phone number and started calling me and inviting me back. And if it hadn't been for her reaching out, I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have gone by. All those people in there were like my mother's age. And I was definitely uncomfortable, even though I related. I don't know that it took courage. It took being devastated. I mean, I was just desperate. I was about as desperate as you can be.
Okay, so if you're in this 12-step program and they talk about a higher power, what were you thinking at the time?
I was not comfortable at all. As a matter of fact, having been raised Jewish and meetings are in churches a lot, I can't say that I was terribly comfortable. It was very weird for me to be sitting in church rooms and awkward, but I really didn't have much of a choice. Because there was nowhere else to go. it's either I knew that this was the last hope that I had, and the only other chance would be is to just die, just kill myself.
Oh boy,
that's tough when both alternatives at one point aren't acceptable, but yet you get the gift of willingness and because of the desperation, and you go, and maybe your idea of God is different, Bill. And it's a different building, but there's something drawing you in there because you want to survive. And what happened after you started going a while? What happened to you spiritually?
Oh, well, a lot. I eventually accepted Jesus, who we call him by his Hebrew name, Yeshua. It was a long time till that happened, but I just started to practice the 12 steps and read thoroughly and study thoroughly the Alcoholics Anonymous literature, and I had trouble actually stopping the overeating. I couldn't stop even with going to meetings and doing everything like that you're supposed to do, all the phone calls and sponsor and everything. I did everything, but I still couldn't stop eating. And I just knew from the people who were wiser than I that the answer was in the steps. And so I kept reading these books. Like I read the big book even while I was eating. And I read the AA 12-step book and I just kept thoroughly reading. And I'm not really much of a reader, but I was desperate. So I was reading these books because I was trying to figure out what this whole thing means. How do you surrender to God? I don't understand. This doesn't make any sense. Of course, it doesn't make any sense to your mind. I mean, that's just doesn't. Surrendering and turn your life over doesn't make sense. So I spent a lot of time reading and studying and also then being open, like to listening to people who were like really strong in recovery and ask them what they did and how they experienced God and practices. And I tried on a few different hats and I found that the only one that really where I experienced any real power was with Christianity, and that was really a challenge for a Jewish girl, but that was definitely the right path for me.
What were some of the challenges in your recovery and you know from your traditions to becoming a Christian?
Social suicide.
Excommunication from the family. What else?
Other than that, nothing.
Everything, actually. It was a total threat to my relationships. It was very awful to go through. But eventually I found other Jewish people, so that helped. And I do worship with in the Messianic Jewish community. So I love that. It took a long time to find that. I was very much a fish out of water in the church. I love to go to church now. I don't have that issue. But at first, I felt always like a little awkward. Like it just was such a strange atmosphere to me. But so eventually, after a few years of being a wandering Jew nomad, listening to Christian radio in secret, trying not to tell anybody, except for my Christian sponsor. And then eventually I found a Messianic community. So that was really cool. So that made it better because then I can worship as a Jew and believe in Jesus.
That's fantastic. So, Rona, I've got a question about the idea of sobriety with an eating addiction. What does sobriety look like when you are dealing with an eating addiction?
Well, that's a good question.
I mean, if you're not drinking or using drugs, you've got sobriety, but you still have to eat. So, what are the boundaries that say this person is living with sobriety?
Yeah, well, that's a good question because I don't believe there's one way. I know Food Addicts Anonymous people, they do. They think the only way that you could be abstinent is if you follow the food plan that they're on. I don't agree with that. I think that people can be free from food addiction and have a number of different ways of eating. The main thing is that they're not abusing food. They're not eating the foods that they're addicted to. Most people have a structured food plan with very clear boundaries and that eliminate the foods that of abuse. You know, like I don't eat sugar and refined carbohydrates. I'm mostly sugar addict, so for me that's the primary thing I need to avoid, and I do. But, you know, each person's a little different. Their level of – I have clients and friends who can eat grains – like whole grain breads, and I have other clients and friends who, you know, they can't even eat whole wheat because that triggers them. And the more rigid food plans, the ones like FA uses, they eliminate all flour. You know, I don't believe everybody who's a food addict needs that kind of rigidity. And so it's very tricky, but I don't know. I think sobriety means a lot more to me than specifically what foods you eat, but it's like a sanity and it's like a freedom. You know how there's dry drunks. There's also people who can follow a diet, but they're not really free. And I see sobriety as when you're really free and you're not fighting and you're not in the battle anymore. You just eat sanely and you don't obsess about food and you don't worry about it. You make sure that you have what you need to make sure you have your healthy, abstinent foods. And you're careful. I mean, I have to, you know, still, I mean, very careful to make sure I have what I need. I'm getting ready to go on a big, to Nashville to speak at a big conference. And tonight I have to figure out what food do I need to put in my suitcase to make sure that I have what I need when I'm there. And you have to think these things through because you can't really count on everybody else to have healthy food. I don't have to like obsess about it and I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to lose my sanity over it. I just know what I have to do. And that's it comes like in the AA big book, it says that you will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle you. And, you instead of being confused, you just know what you're doing. And there's peace and sanity. But it's definitely a trial and error thing for many people with food. If you go to rehab, they'll put you on a food plan. And, you know, if you're real good, you'll just stick with the food plan they give you. But most people will do something different than what they're given, and they may work with a nutritionist or, you know, to kind of figure out where their boundaries with food need to be.
All right, we're going to take one more little short break. We've got one more segment coming up with Rona Epstein. Thanks for joining us tonight. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to Real Recovery. Thanks for being with us tonight. Talking to Rona Epstein tonight. And Rona, I was just speaking glowingly about your decision to make sure you have all the food you need in your suitcase on your trip to Nashville this week. And I think, boy, you make plans to succeed. And I think there's so many occasions where I'll make some of my worst food decisions when I'm just sort of in a situation where you're at the airport or somewhere and you just have nothing to eat. And you can't imagine getting on a flight for 2 or 3 hours on an empty stomach. So you just eat what's ever there. And you're always putting yourself in a position to succeed and not to fail. And I think that's just really an inspiration.
Well, Bill,
you know what? For me, it's not a choice. It's life and death for me.
Okay.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, if I go without a plan, I'm very much likely to be in some hot water, and I'm not going to eat the foods that I'm addicted to. So if I don't think things through and really, you know, I sometimes have to look at a menu or really have to think through, am I going to be able to get what I have a friend who's going to be driving to this conference in Nashville. And I mean, a few weeks ago, I already talked to her about whether or not she can drive me around to the store to make sure that the things I can't put in my suitcase that I can go and get and have in the hotel. And, you know, I set it up. I had to think way ahead of time to make sure that I have what I need. It's a pain in the neck, but it's the only way, because you see, I can't count on things that I need to be there. I just can't.
And that still feels liberating to you, doesn't it? It doesn't feel like you're trapped, or it doesn't feel like you're living with these huge restrictions. It feels like you're living with liberation, because this is what I'm going to be choosing to do and choosing to eat, and this is how I'm preparing for it.
Yeah, exactly. And then I'm not worried about it, because I know the alternative is, if I do just eat whatever's there, that will start the whole obsession and the insanity. And I don't want that. I don't want to do anything that's going to make my head crazy and start making me obsess about what I'm doing. And then I don't want to trigger cravings or start to be tempted to go. And then I'll come home and I'm a big giant mess. And how long will it take before I'm completely out of control? You got to know where your lines are.
Yeah, especially if you're going to a conference to talk about food addictions, right? You really got to be prepared for battle, don't you?
Yeah, well, it's tough. I mean, it's at the Opryland Hotel, and it's tough. I've been there many times, and they don't have a lot of healthy food in Nashville, FYI, at least not that I can see.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to end up eating a little boring because I get the same few things that I know I can get while I'm there. But, I chicken Caesar salad for lunch, chicken Caesar salad for dinner.
Have you tried the chicken Caesar salad at breakfast? Because that's also nice. You get that nice garlic throughout the day, and nobody wants to talk to you.
Yeah, but, I get through. I figure it out. It all works out.
One of the things I really like about your story is this wasn't a one and done, that you came in and you were willing and it didn't go great, but you stuck with it and you had a plan to stay in there, whatever happened. And now we have a plan to keep our recovery going. I think for our listeners, we need to work our recovery as hard as we worked our using. And we don't get to a point where we have to, where we're okay, that we have permanent sobriety or recovery because we've done the work. We have to do this every day, don't we?
Every day. Every day. And it's not just the food, because that would be, it would feel, and I guess to somebody who doesn't really understand the spiritual experience of surrender, they might think that what I do is like bondage. Like, you have to work so hard to make sure you have this and that, and that doesn't feel like freedom. But it is freedom when you don't have that enslavement to the food and the food obsession. But I think the daily work is much more spiritual than anything, because it's dependent on my connection with the Lord. And if that goes off, that's the beginning of going in the wrong direction. And I really think that ultimately that's the work, is making sure to try to make sure that I have my head and my heart in the right place with the Lord. And that's the harder work. I mean, that's harder than putting a food plan together, because, you know, it's easy to get busy, and which I've been lately. And, that quiet time is so important, and that recognition, who's the reason. I mean, the reason I'm free is because of him, not because of me.
See, I see that in working the recovery, Rona, as an act of worship and not an act of enslavement. That's how I have always looked at the recovery, is it ties in with step three, that I'm turning my whole life over to the care of God, And my requirement on that end, once I do that, is to take care of what I need to do, to work the steps and to get enough sleep and to be in the Word and to say a prayer and to eat the right food. So to me, that comes out of Romans 12, that, you know, we give our body as a holy living a sacrifice acceptable to God. It's an act of worship. It's not enslavement.
Yes, it is.
It's a lot of work, but, you know, it works.
But that's the thing. You're blessed in that. I mean, that's the thing. There's a choice between, as much as it seems to be hard to discipline yourself for prayer or whatever it is, whether, you know, for, I know it is challenging for me, wake myself up extra early and make sure that I spend my time in the Word. But boy, the payoff is peace and sanity and freedom. And, you know, it's a wonderful thing. And it's a lot different without that. It's a lot different. So it's not that big of a price to pay for what you get.
Rona, if you're like me, and I know I am, I've always had a fair amount of difficulty trying to initiate conversations with Jewish people about Christ, and I've usually come up against a pretty big wall. So I'm really fascinated as to the person that connected with you and got your attention. And you were willing to continue to listen and not disregard them because you must have had your own little wall up. Culturally and religiously, you're up against a lot to say, I want to continue to have a conversation about Jesus. Because I haven't gotten very far, George, in my conversations with Jewish people.
Yeah, no, there tends to be a lot of closed doors there. That's really true. I'm pretty sure that if I wasn't so desperate, I wouldn't. I mean, I hate to say it. I wish I could say, you know, oh, yes, I was so moved by what I heard. But I really was just desperate. And this person who was my sponsor, who was a Christian woman, her life really spoke to me. And when she said to me, actually, she had the guts and the boldness to say to me, look, I don't think you're ever going to get better. Unless you turn your life over to Jesus. And I can't believe she said that, really. It was pretty bold and not typical of what you hear in a 12-step program. But she said that to me, and so I said a prayer to accept Jesus in my heart. Now, and that, it wasn't like a straight line to Jesus from there. It was like years still after that of kind of testing the waters, and I really didn't know what I was doing. But I was definitely open. I mean, I was open to other things too. But I think, like, as I said, I mean, it was clear to me that any other thing I might have been open to wasn't right, and that everything I was hearing about Christianity and seeing from the few people who God put in my life, that there were visible evidence of spirituality that to me was what I wanted.
So in response to your question, Bill, this lady had something that she wanted. She was willing to go to any lengths to get it.
Uh-huh.
So,
is that your whole point, George?
Yeah.
I think
it's true.
You know, a little joke there, but I think one of the things you were so effective with at the Army is you have a happy, joyous, and free faith, Bill. You just don't go down there and tell people what they need to do. You share what you're doing and how happy you are doing it. And my guess is with this lady, not having met her, she had what you wanted, and even though it was a lot different than what you were doing, eventually you got it. And I think that's the best witness, don't you?
Yeah, I think so. But I think it is true with Jewish people that, you know, we were raised not, you know, to feel like the world's against you and that it's sort of like this turning against your people thing. It's a bit of an art. But I definitely think that it's God's will for the Jewish people to come to faith. And so I don't stop talking to them, because you never know what seed you're planting. And even if a person doesn't respond or seem to be responding, you just never know. And also, I think that there are some people who are open. I wouldn't assume because a person's Jewish that you shouldn't share your faith, because you just never know. There are some people who just have never heard and they don't know anything really about it. They just, I mean, it's like it's a mission field that's right in front of our eyes, right there. You don't have to go to another country. They're right here in your backyard. And, you know, when you're raised like I was, Jesus is just for the other people. It's nothing to do with you, you know.
See, I love that, George.
They don't know. They don't even know.
Yeah, I love that. It's a real encouragement. coming from you, Rona. So I really, really appreciate that. You know, when we have Rona on, the hour flies by, and there's always so much more to talk about and questions to ask. And I know listeners tonight are looking at their own food plan and their own relationship to food going, how am I doing in this department? And it's something that with prayer and surrender, I know God can help you with all of your problems if you have some. And God can release you from the bondage of a food addiction. And I think that's why we always want to show up and do Real Recovery on Sundays, George. We give people a chance to hear from various experts, and Rona is one of our favorites. And unfortunately, that wraps up our hour on Real Recovery tonight. So, Rona, thanks again. And, Alex, thank you, George.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate all the listeners tonight. Good night, everyone. Have a great week. God bless.